This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Judge Albert G. Weber III. Well, Judge Weber, I noticed that you're the third generation of Albert G. Weber. Can you tell us something about your family?
Well, I try to be as modest as possible.
Well, we want you to tell us the facts. After all, you're a judge.
It is true. I'm a third generation lawyer. I might add that the fourth generation with the same name has started practice in Decatur about a year ago. My grandfather came here as an immigrant boy in 1863. He had some small jobs, as boys would, around Decatur, which was a small village in those days. I remember his telling me that his first job was to chop wood down in Lincoln Square. Wood, timber, was used as fuel for houses and businesses, and that's about all a boy, he was about 11, I think, could do. He received some minimal wage of 2 or 3 cents an hour for chopping the wood. His mother, who lived with him and his sister out on West Prairie, would come down and sit on the wood pile and cry and say, why did they ever leave the old country? But at any rate, he got into various jobs, finally got into railroading, worked for the Rock Island. He had a passenger run from Keokuk to Des Moines, and he said he noticed that the people who looked the most prosperous on his trains were lawyers. So he decided to become a lawyer. He set up arrangements with a law firm in Des Moines and another one in Keokuk, borrowing their books, law books, and reading them in the baggage car. After he'd taken up his tickets, after he'd done that for about 5 years, he felt qualified to take his bar examination. In those days, there was no formal exam as there is now. You simply appeared before the local circuit judge and two practicing lawyers. They examined you orally, and if they were satisfied, the judge entered up an order admitting you to the bar. So that's what he did, and then came to Decatur here, which was his hometown. His family still lived here. In 1879, and hung out his shingle in the 100 block of East Prairie. It's a building, today there's a ladies ready-to-wear shop there, Williams I think the name is, but that was the Universalist Church in an early day. And if you look at the building, you can still see some of the lineaments of the church. On the north face, it's built up. Really, that parapet has been revised considerably in recent years because of deteriorating masonry, but the east and west faces show a typical church mm-hmm. window with an eyebrow top to it. At any rate, there was a grain trading organization, brokerage sort of, on the ground floor. He rented a desk for 50 cents a month in the corner of the brokerage office. I suppose picked up his first clients with the traders who would step over and pick up the dime's worth of legal advice or whatever. As soon as he got a little more prosperous, he moved up to the second floor of that building and had a private office then. Remember, too, is telling that all of the offices were heated by coal stoves, and that he'd order half a ton of coal, which would be dumped on the sidewalk down below, and he'd have to carry it up the stairs to the office and store it up there somewhere. Rather far cry, Betty, from our sitting in an air-cooled building with all of the utilities furnished, but...
And that wasn't too long ago.
No, well, 102 years.
Not too long.
At any rate, he began his practice, and my father joined him in 1918. My father went to the University of Illinois Law School and graduated and took his bar exam in 1917, but went off to World War I. And, well, I misspoke myself. He began January 1st, 1919. He got out of the Navy, I think, in December of 1918. And they commenced their practice together in 1919. I started to law school in 1941, but then we got into all that unpleasantness with Japan and Germany, and I was in military then for 4.5 years and completed law school after the war, and came back here, and I started in 1948. I was elected to the circuit bench in 1966 and assigned then to the appellate bench in 1979. My son, mentioned a moment ago, received his shingle and started in November of last year, 1981. So for better or for worse, we've 4 generations have been hacking the legal profession in Decatur for 103 years now.
That really is a thrilling story of how much one family can contribute.
Well, it's coincidental,
well,
I think. Although I'm quite sure that the family never considered any alternative for me, that I was to be a lawyer from the day I was born, but I tried to impress on my son that I didn't want him to be a lawyer unless he wanted to be, that it made no particular difference to me what he wanted to do, just so long as he was the best. And,
but he chose it.
He chose the law.
Good. Let's go back to some of the stories of your grandfather, if you don't mind. I believe you said he knew the Milliken family.
Yes, this came about more as a matter of geography than anything else. He and his mother, and he had an older sister, came here from Germany in 1863, and his mother, my great-grandmother, had a small purse of gold coins that she had received from the sale of her house in Germany. And she was a widow. Her husband died over there, and she decided to come over to this area because there were some other relatives about whom I don't know anything really, who had come before and were living in the Decatur Springfield area. And with that small purse of gold coin, she bought a small cottage which stood near the corner of West Prairie and Pine, about where the new condominia are there now. And to the west of Pine was the large tract of land that Mr. Milliken had bought some years before to build his home. Of course, this was 1863, and he didn't build the house until about 13 years later, but he did own the property. He and Mrs. Milliken were living down the street at the corner of, it wasn't down the street, it was the corner of William and Edward, where the old day nursery is. At any rate, apparently Milliken would come out from time to time to inspect his property, and here was a young boy living across the road, and as I recall the story, he'd hire him from time to time to do small chores around the place, clean out the underbrush and sort of look after the property for him. And after my grandfather came back to Decatur in 79, Milliken still remembered him, and the two of them remained close friends throughout Milliken's life. And matter of fact, I recall reading the Milliken obituary in the old Decatur Review, and they referred to grandfather as a confidential advisor to Mr. Milliken. I don't believe he ever did any legal work for him, but the two of them were quite close over the years from the early 1880s until Milliken's death in 1909. All again growing out of just a neighborhood relationship there. Older man sort of looking after the younger boy who was living in the area.
Eventually the Milliken home was built there.
Yes.
And they were then close neighbors.
It was, I think by the time the Milliken home was built, my grandfather had bought some property and built his own house out in the 1500 block of North Church Street. Family lived there until the middle 1890s. At that time they moved down onto Ewing Avenue, the corner of Ewing and Forest. House still stands there, and he died in that house in 1947. But during the early time when he was here, 1863 to say about 10 years later, he did live in the vicinity of the Milliken property. And later on had a considerable hand in the establishment of Milliken University. He knew from his relationship with Mr. Milliken that Milliken was interested in establishing a school. He was also a friend of a minister from the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. The minister was Reverend Hawkins, and grandfather knew that Cumberlands were having some difficulty financing what was then Lincoln College. So it's a rather involved story, but he acted as the go-between between Reverend Hawkins and the Cumberland Presbyterians and Mr. Milliken, who wanted to establish a school. And the end result was that they obtained the Cumberland charter for a college, and Mr. Milliken contributed one-third of the cost, and Milliken University was established and built, opened in 1903. So he had considerable hand there. He also had lifetime connections with the Mueller family, one of his early jobs was as an apprentice to Hieronymus Mueller. Mm-hmm. Mueller was a plumber, and he hired, again, the young boy as an apprentice. And again, when he returned to practice law in 1879, his old boss, Mr. Mueller, was hunting for someone to do legal work for him and his family, so he hired his old apprentice, who remained as general counsel for the family and for the company until 1936, when my father took over, and then I did considerable work in my time for both the family and for the company. But the Mueller story is...
That's another chapter.
Another chapter.
Okay. We'll try to get that later.
Get into it here.
Well, we've started on your career now. You just fell in with the work your grandfather and father were doing and then went on from there, right?
Yes, I decided in 1966 that it might be a little different to try for the bench. Judge Morthland had been the sitting circuit judge here in Macon County. He died in 1964. I had served as his master in chancery from 1957, and I was approached by a variety of people to seek his job. It was a major decision. If you have a fairly comfortable law practice,
you don't give it up lightly.
Why do you want to give it up to go into a political fight? In those days, the judgeship was a matter of election, and campaigning in six counties, and sitting on all kinds of platforms and listening to the coroner's views on Vietnam, which was a hot political issue at the time. All pretty traumatic, but I managed to win the election and stayed on the bench ever since.
Did you find there were compensations for giving up your practice?
Oh, I think so. There are pressures in any occupation. Pressures of the bench are much different from the pressures of the law practice, but I think the appellate work particularly is appealing because you have the feeling that you're advancing the law, you're on the cutting edge where you're making precedent for others to follow. And in that sense, it's perhaps a little more rewarding than the trial bench. But the trial bench is more fun because that's where all the action is. Trials are going on. There's the pokers get hot and tempers flare. And you've got to be the ringmaster, while the appellate work is very cloistered. It's all done, as in the office here.
Behind the scenes.
Writing of opinions and... you rarely see anybody except the two lawyers who are arguing the case before you. So there's a difference in your compensations both ways, but to sum it all up, I wouldn't do it any differently if I were to start over again today.
You've enjoyed both sides.
Yes, very much. The practice, well, all of the structure of law, I think, has changed a good deal more radically in my time than in all of the generations before. Oh, when I came here, 1948, we had no such thing as a public defender.
excuse me, were you in the old courthouse ever? Maybe you can tell, before you go into the public defender, maybe you can tell us what the old courthouse was like.
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. I said a moment ago, the family decided from the time I was 5 minutes old and I was going to be a lawyer.
You were going to be the third one in the family.
In order to assure this future, I was put out at age 10, perhaps, to work in the family law office as sort of the office boy or the errand boy, whatever. And I'm almost 62 years old now, so all this was happening more than 50 years ago, and of course the old courthouse was standing on the corner out to the street of water and wood where the present county building is. Many of my chores out of the office were to carry papers down to the courthouse or to pick up forms there. There was a great deal of posting of notices in those days. Today, legal readers appear in the newspapers, but in that era, every lawyer had his box of tacks and his tack hammer and claim notices for estates and notices of sales and the like were all posted on telephone poles. And the first one that was always posted was on the bulletin board outside the north door of the courthouse. And I had to do quite a lot of this, but the building was interesting. It had a tall tower, looked a great deal like the First Presbyterian Church. Matter of fact, I think both buildings were built at about the same time with the same architect. But the main entrance was on Wood Street, a rounded Romanesque curve, and as you went inside the door, there was a huge marble stairway that went up to the second floor. And on the west side of the second floor was the old county court where Judge McCoy held forth. And John Hamilton McCoy was cast in a mold all of his own. The county court was sort of the center of activity for the county. They did all of the estate work. They did a small amount of civil practice, some small criminal practice, but the circuit court was the big one where all of the important litigation went on, but everything else happened in the county court. And Judge McCoy was sort of the legal advisor to the whole county. And I can see him yet. His bench was against the west side of the room. He had an old Al Capone telephone, which was the type everybody had in those days. It was upright where the receiver went on a hook on the side. He had the phone attached to the window casing by a sort of accordion metal extension business, and he'd sit on that bench all day. He'd transact business by telephone. He was a pipe smoker, and he had a great big barrel of Briggs mixture. It was a pipe tobacco that was popular at the time. It was sold in what looked like a replica of a barrel, a wooden thing about 8 or 10 inches high and perhaps 5-6 inches in diameter. Today, a judge smoking on the bench or answering the telephone on the bench, it would be a public scandal, if not a calamity, but nobody thought anything about it in those days, and Judge McCoy just sat there and in a most beneficent fashion transacted whatever business came before mm-hmm. him and was comfortable on his bench with his Briggs mixture and his telephone. And he was always interested in the Boy Scouts, too. And he was the advisor and the examiner for several of the Boy Scout merit badges. Mm-hmm. I remember going down to him to get my merit badge in civics. Mm-hmm. The first thing he did was tell me to step up on the bench alongside of him, handed me a sheet of paper and a pencil, and said, "Now draw a map of Illinois." Might just as well have told me to reproduce in short order with my watercolors from grade school the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Apparently I must have at least come up with a reasonable facsimile, because I did get the merit badge. But that old courthouse stood until the late 1930s, and we had some sort of amusing things that happened there too. In order not to interrupt the flow of government business, the county board kept the old building while they were building the new one. And the trouble was that the new one was just a little too big. They had to take out the southeast corner.
Oh, it was built on the same side.
Same side. The northwest corner of the present county building protruded, as I recall, 6, 7, 8 feet into the southeast corner of the old building, which was the circuit clerk's vault up on the third floor. So the clerk had to move many of his records, and the only place that was available that had enough space was the ladies' restroom. So that every time you needed a file from the circuit clerk's office, you had to go in and get a hold of Dorothy Brown, who was chief deputy in Harry Butt's clerk's office, and ask Dorothy to go down to the ladies' room and get the file out for you. These were the circumstances they had to live under while the new building was being built. Circuit court room was up on the third floor, and the judges' chambers were, circuit judges' chambers were up there. The sheriff roosted on the ground floor, as he does now, and many of the sheriffs lived in a huge old house that was just to the east of the old building. Mm-hmm. It had a big iron fence across the front of it, security purposes, and it was back in that courtyard that several of the hangings in Macon County took place. Mm-hmm. One of them was in 1927. I don't remember it. I suppose my father locked us all up at home so mm-hmm. that nobody could go down to watch. But
Was the public permitted?
Oh, yes. As far as anybody could get close enough to see if he wanted to. But press accounts at the time indicate that a rather large crowd turned out for it. I'd sell my seat at a hanging awfully cheaply. Wouldn't want to be there. After the new building was opened up in 1938, then there were newer and more modern courtrooms, and that for the first time, one of the few areas in Decatur that was centrally air-conditioned were the two courtrooms in the present county building, circuit court and county court. And that result was that all of the judges in the state wanted to come here to hold court in the summertime, because it was so nice and cool. But the practice has changed a lot. We had no public defender. Mm-hmm. every time the grand jury met and brought back a spate of indictments, the circuit judge would just go down his list and appoint all the younger lawyers as counsel for the defendants. And that's where we all received our trial training.
Did you receive compensation for
no,
that?
No, didn't get a dime.
Was it part of your education?
It was considered part of the educational process. as I recall, in one instance, I believe the statute at the time said if it's a capital case, which meant death would be the possible penalty, and this would be only for murder, appointed counsel was entitled to a fee of, I think, $150. And murder cases were fairly rare in those days. They did turn up occasionally. There was one famous one that was tried in 1949, People versus Clark. I recall Mr. Carl Miller, who still practices in Decatur, was appointed and to assist him, Mr. Richard Welsh, who was my former law partner when I was in the practice, and the two of them worked for weeks and weeks on that case. Recall it particularly because Judge Morthland invalidated a confession which they had obtained from the defendant. This was long before the days of the Warren Court, mm-hmm. when we heard about Miranda and voluntary mm-hmm. confessions and all, but as a matter of common law, Judge Morthland held that the confession was extorted mm-hmm. and would not allow its admission, and with that the state's attorney had to cave in because mm-hmm. the confession was the only evidence that he had. Mm-hmm. And Judge Morthland was very much before his time. This was mm-hmm. almost 20 years before the major criminal decisions, but he was a very brilliant mm-hmm. judge. Big set of shoes to follow, but in that case too, the jury was sequestered because of the publicity of the mm-hmm. connection with the trial, and they kept them in two small rooms up on the third floor of the courthouse, and they were not permitted in the courtroom while the proceedings were going on concerning the suppression of the confession, mm-hmm. which was really the whole trial. Mm-hmm. So that poor jury lived up in those two little rooms on the third floor for about a week. And mm-hmm. can recall they sent down and asked the judge if they could go to the movies just to have something to do. He made arrangements at the old Lincoln Theater to have the mezzanine cleared out, and the bailiffs took the jurors over to see the movie, just to have a little diversion. And Lloyd Smith, who was chief bailiff, used to take them for a walk. They'd go out and see this group of 12 people and two bailiffs walking around the block, around the courthouse, but I have sequestered some juries in my time, but I think now we've reached the point that we believe the juries are sufficiently sophisticated mm-hmm. that rarely are they locked up anymore. And we heard a lot about the Hinckley jury recently, where Hinckley had taken a pot shot at the president, and they were squirreled away in some motel, but it's unusual.
And really, there's more opportunity for them to be, we might say, contaminated now than before.
With television, particularly. But they're admonished every time court goes into recess not to talk to anybody, don't read any newspaper accounts. And, generally, I think they obey. It's not nearly the problem that we envisioned years ago. But the appointments were worthwhile. You had mostly sure losers, but you always remember your losses. You never remember your victories. And it was a good training ground, and I think the younger lawyers today really lost a lot in
by not having to take
not having had that experience. And the whole judicial structure was changed in 1964 with the judicial amendment that went through to the Constitution. Before that time, the court structure was a hodgepodge. There were all sorts of courts. The circuit judge was all. He ruled the roost. That's no longer true. We had no jury instructions in those days. We have what we call pattern instructions now that are rather standard and are given in nearly all trials, but there would be maybe a two-day trial and it would take 3 days of argument to settle the instructions. Trial procedures were considerably different. But as I have to keep reminding myself, all that is more than 30 years ago, and probably half, three-quarters of the bar practicing today were not even born when all that was going on. And it gets interesting to talk to them now and to get their impression of what practice is now as compared to what it was 30 years ago. And it's my experience, of course, would be considerably different from someone like, say, Mr. Tom Samuels, who began his practice in 1914, which would have been under even much different circumstances. Well, I've rambled on here a lot about the past. Our problems now are really that of litigation explosion. For example, the court I'm now on, the Fourth District Appellate Court, during its first full year of operation under the Judicial Amendment of 1962, handled 89 appeals, three judges on the court. This amounted to about 30 cases apiece for them during that year. Last year, with five judges on the court, we had over 900 appeals filed, and we took 600 of them for opinion. Same thing is happening on the trial level. In Macon County alone, there are about 25,000 filings per year. This would include, of course, everything from major criminal, major civil, down through traffic and misdemeanor cases. But to paraphrase Gertrude Stein, a case is a case is a case. Somebody has to tend to it, whether it's a murder case or whether it's running a stoplight or whether it's a small claim for rent or whether it's a multi-million dollar class action suit. The litigation explosion is the thing that I'm afraid, may overwhelm the system because we are still operating with the quill pen, the green eye shade, the high stool type of mechanism, attempting to deal with the explosive situation where the caseload is preceded by geometric proportions, but the infrastructure, that is the number of people, the method of handling the thing, is still something that Lord Blackstone himself would be thoroughly at home with if he were to step in today. So,
what's the answer?
If I knew, I would publish it, copyright it, and retire, because I could get $1 million per volume for it. There are a number of things that we are doing, and I'm sure will be improved upon, expanded in the future. We're doing a great deal of word processing and computer handling of cases, but there will have to be some fundamental changes in the law. Our Constitution, of course, guarantees a jury trial to any civil case where the amount in controversy is $25 or more. This has long since been abolished in England. On the civil side, they have jury trials only in the most far-reaching and significant civil cases. On the criminal side, juries should always be used for major felonies. It's a constitutional right, but the jury is overworked. We allow too much to be litigated. I think we're going to have to concentrate on what properly belongs in the courts, what properly belongs in the legislature, what properly belongs with the executive, and do not permit anybody who's got the price of a filing fee to come in and file a lawsuit. There are some matters that are simply not justiciable. They are beyond the ability of a court to adjudicate. Now, most of my brothers would not agree with me on this. It's in the nature of a judge to have a elephantine ego and an ability to
solve any problem.
He himself is capable of solving all problems, but it simply isn't true. The legislature has the power to investigate, which is really at the root of many of the problems. Someone can come into your courtroom and say, I've got a problem. Very well, he may have a problem, but the question is, how widespread is the problem? If it doesn't involve a great many people, the court should stay away from it.
Some could be solved person to person.
Yes, and to allow the legislature to decide whether there is a real social problem here, or whether it's a personal problem with a couple of people. This is where we get into many of the class action suits, these far-reaching things that the courts are making social policy when they should really be settling personal disputes. There will have to be a trimming of justiciable matters. On the appeal level, the appeals become too repetitive. We right now have on the docket in our court, just finished rather, the fifth appeal growing out of a single divorce case. The parties simply cannot agree on anything, so so they resort to the court time after time, which is an infringement on the rights of other litigants who should have their day in court, too. I'm sure that eventually all this will be solved, and as time goes by, new methods appear. Problem, I suppose, is the law always lags behind social progress. It takes the law sometimes a generation to catch up with what's been going on elsewhere in the world, but I'm confident that we'll live through it and that the system will survive.
You think your sons or grandsons will take care of it?
Well, if they come in and listen to this tape 30 years from now, they're going to think that the old man was living in the Dark Ages, because the progress will be exponential over the next generation or two. This has been the history of the matter, and progress in all fields was relatively steady paced up until perhaps 30, 40 years ago, but as we all know, it's gone at a much faster rate. Alvin Toffler made himself a bundle of money by writing Future Shock, which was just on that theory that social progress was going much faster than the human mind could digest and assimilate it. And there's every indication that will continue, and I think it would be interesting if these tapes last long enough that our successor is yours and mine, Betty, can 30 years from now make a new set of tapes and play them for the populace at that time.
But we hope, though, that these people will have as rich and full a life as you have had.
Oh, dear.
And
well, it's been simply that of the Midwestern lawyer who happened to be born into the tradition that was established. And, I've been very happy with it. I've been very happy with Decatur.
Well, we certainly thank you for sharing these experiences with us, and we have enjoyed your stories of your family and your experiences here in Decatur. And thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to the reminiscences of Judge A.G. Weber III. This is Betty Turnell for the Decatur Public Library.